Guns are a public health crisis, and that crisis at this point is unchecked. Public health. This is how David Hemenway has approached his study of gun violence over the decades. He's a health policy professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He directs the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. It found that 22% of gun owners obtained their most recent gun without a background check. This hour, how can gun violence be tackled from a public health perspective? David Hemenway thinks about this question a ton. He joins us now. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, this conversation about gun violence when a Las Vegas shooting happens, a mass shooting happens, quickly turns to policy and politics. You're making the case that this is not necessarily a political issue, but a public health threat. Can you explain that?
Well, every day in the United States, on an average day, over 300 people are shot and about 100 die. And then we have all this fear caused by guns. And then in inner cities in particularly, we have large numbers of people traumatized by exposure to violence from guns. So it's a major public health problem. It also costs a lot in terms of medical care and so forth.
You've been looking at this for decades now, and when a Las Vegas shooting happens, a mass shooting like this happens, what are some of the things that go to your mind? How do you think about your research in the context of a Las Vegas mass shooting?
Well, the problem is that these shootings in the United States are just so predictable. We don't know where they will occur or when, but we can sort of predict, oh, yes, they're going to be, you know, a certain number every year in the United States, and a much, much higher number than in any other industrialized democracy. And there are sort of two dozen other of these high-income countries. And the reason we have so many more is not because we are more monsters, we have more monsters in the United States, or we have more mental health problems. It's because we make it incredibly easy for people who have problems, for people who behave antisocially, to get firearms and any firearms they want.
And the U.S. also has a lot of guns, is that right?
That's right. We have by far the most guns per capita, I think, of any country. And so not only do we have lots and lots of guns, but we have the by far the weakest gun laws of any high-income country.
Walk us through some of those laws. First of all, the background checks that we've been hearing so much of recently. What do we know about background checks and what the law is?
In virtually every other country, there's much stronger background checks than we have in the United States. For example, in Canada, in order to get a gun, you need two people to attest that you are a good citizen. They check with your wife or ex-wife to make sure you're not engaged in intimate partner violence. And it's a much more like an FBI background check than, oh my god, you just aren't on some list. Secondly, there's gun licensing every place, just as there's licensing to drive a car in the United States. There's licensing to own guns in all these other countries. And then a key thing is that there's universal background checks. So you have to show your license whenever you're obtaining a firearm. In the United States, as you mentioned, we just did a study, and about one out of five gun acquisitions, there is no background check whatsoever.
Why is that?
Because we have very weak gun laws, and we have decided not to really do anything about our problem. If we really wanted to make a difference, we could, in the public health standpoint, we could all get together and say, first we have to decide, yes, we have a problem, and then we get everybody together, the gun manufacturers, the gun dealers, the clergy, the foundations, the government, the researchers, and we say, what can we do and what can each party do to try to really make a difference? And if we all sat together and said, yes, here's what gun owners could do, here's what the mental health people could do, we could really make a difference in the United States.
You also have made light of this notion or this fact that the research dollars for studying gun violence, they just aren't there. What's going on there?
Yeah, so it's really very sad. You know, some countries like Japan, which has almost no guns and incredibly strong gun laws and almost no gun problem, they don't need a lot of research. But in the United States, we have a lot of guns, we're going to always have a lot of guns, and we have this enormous problem, so we really want to figure out how to live with our guns. Right now we are dying with our guns. So from a public health standpoint and really from a scientific standpoint, one of the big problems is there are a lot of data which are deliberately not collected. There are a lot of data which are collected which are deliberately withheld from researchers. And then it's almost been made impossible for the federal government to fund researchers. I'm at a public health school, and we get money from the federal government to research obesity. We get money to research AIDS. We get money to research malaria, but it's almost impossible for anyone to get very much money at all to research firearm fatalities or firearm injuries.
We're talking right now with David Hemenway. He is a health policy professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He recently wrote an opinion piece in the Boston Globe. It's titled "Tackling Gun Control as a Public Health Problem." Is it a health problem? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Should there be more research, more legislation? If you could enact a bill, what would it do? Join in, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, you've brought to light things that happen in other countries to help curb gun violence. One of those countries, Australia, you mentioned, did a gun buyback program that has really turned out over the decades to have been beneficial?
It really looks like it. 20 years ago, after their Port Arthur massacre in Tasmania, finally a conservative prime minister said enough is enough. Excuse me. And what they did is they said, we're going to buy back the most lethal military weapons, and we're going to try to get rid of them in society, and then we're going to really tighten up our gun laws. And so in the 20 years before the Port Arthur massacre, there had been over between 11 to 13 gun massacres. In the 20 years since, there's been zero. The number of gun homicides, the number of gun suicides has fallen by over 50%. So it looks like an incredibly successful intervention. Something I should also mention that is in the public health approach, laws matter also, but so does social norms. Social norms really matter. So, for example, in one of the big success stories, and I'm really big on trying to understand where we've had successes in the past and how we can replicate them in certain ways. We've had a great success in the motor vehicle area. And the reason we had great success there is that 60 years ago, we finally decided that we're not going to just focus on the individual driver. Yes, it's no question that if all individual drivers were defensive drivers and always alert and never made mistakes and never disobeyed the law, we could have eliminated 98% of our traffic crashes. But it's really hard to change people like that. And so what we did instead is...
Because people are human.
Yes.
They make mistakes.
What we did instead is we said, we're going to, yes, try to get drivers to be better, but we're also going to really change the cars. And we made cars much, much more safer with airbags and seat belts and collapsible steering columns. We made the roads much, much safer. We improved the emergency medical system. And we changed social norms. We changed social norms, for example, about drunk driving. Drunk driving was always illegal, but we tried to make it clear that it is no longer appropriate to say, oh, I'm just going to a cocktail party. Of course, I'm going to drive drunk home. How else am I going to get home? He said, that is not appropriate behavior. And so we helped reduce drunk driving. And 60 years later, fatalities, nobody thinks drivers today are better than they were 60 years ago. We're better about drunk driving or worse about distracted driving. But fatalities per mile driven have fallen close to 90%. An incredible success story. Now, it isn't the zero, which would then there's lots of more things we can do, but the notion is what you really want to do is make it hard to make mistakes, hard to behave inappropriately, and then when some people do, very few people die. And we can use that approach about guns. And one of the things about motor vehicles, which is most important, is that we have an incredibly good data system, and we have a good amount of money for research, so we know what works. We don't always do it, but we often do it. And so we know what kinds of policies and what kinds of programs will make the most sense and what won't.
The U.S. has more guns than any other country in the world. It also has far more gun deaths than any other developed nation. So perhaps if you control for other variables, you can make the leap and say that America's easy access to guns seems to lead to more gun violence and death. We're trying to understand that, trying to understand this correlation and other data on gun violence. This hour with David Hemenway. He's a health policy professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And you can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Should there be more research, more legislation? If you could design a bill, what would it do to help curb gun violence? Join in, 800-642-1234. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're discussing how to tackle gun control, how to curb the gun violence with David Hemenway. He's a health policy professor at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. The CEO of the National Rifle Association says stricter gun control laws do not prevent mass shootings. Wayne LaPierre was interviewed by Sean Hannity last week on Fox News. Let's take a listen.
What you've got to do is you've got to go in and take them off the street and put them in prisons. I mean, if legislation worked, Boston Massacre wouldn't have happened. San Bernardino, where California has every gun law you can imagine on the books, that wouldn't have happened. In Paris, where they have complete gun bans, that wouldn't have happened. Brussels, all over the world, where the people are disarmed, these monsters, these bad guys, go about their business. They could care less what laws are on the books.
That's NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre saying that making it more difficult to carry a gun does not prevent gun violence. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Hemenway, what do you make of Wayne LaPierre's argument here?
Oh, it's really silly. It's sort of like saying we still have motor vehicle deaths, and so motor vehicle changes in motor vehicles don't matter. What the evidence is overwhelming is that where you have strong laws and fewer guns, you don't necessarily have zero deaths or zero mass shootings, but you have many, many fewer. And that's what you see throughout. One of the things we look at, too, is try to compare states across the United States.
Yeah.
Try to compare cities across the United States. See if we can hold everything else constant except guns. So you can try to control for the amount of crime, non-gun crime, and so forth, and the amount of mental health problems. And the overwhelming evidence is that in states like Massachusetts, which Wayne LaPierre mentioned, where there are few guns and strong gun laws, we have much, much lower death rates from guns than a state like Wisconsin, which has about average gun laws for the United States and average amounts of guns, and we do much better than states like Louisiana, which has lots of guns and very, very weak laws. And you look at not three states, but you look at all the states, you look at all the cities. One of the things which the evidence is just overwhelming about is suicide. More than a dozen case control studies. That is, you look at people who have died in suicides, you look at people who are similar, who have attempted suicides or have mental health problems, who didn't die in a suicide. And the big difference is the people who died have guns in the home, and they use the guns. And the people who didn't die don't have the guns in the home, and they didn't use the guns, and they took 500 pills, but they were able to be resuscitated. And then they don't go on to commit suicide.
Michael on Facebook wants to mention this. He says, make sure to look at the entire problem, not just statistics. He says the vast majority of gun deaths are from suicides, which could certainly be considered a public mental health issue. And the vast majority of the remaining deaths are from inner city crime, which would be considered a social health issue. Once these numbers are removed from the statistics, the gun violence rates in our country are quite low. We should always seek to find ways to make violence even lower, but compared to the rest of the world, we are doing something very right.
Well, for example, when you look at death, there's no question that suicides are always greater than homicides, gun suicides greater than gun homicides. If you look at non-fatals, our gun assault rates are much, much higher than gun suicide rates. one of the things I should emphasize, too, is the United States, even if we look at only whites in the United States and compare that to everybody in these other countries, their minorities and majorities, our gun death rates are still incredibly higher. Instead of being 12 times higher, maybe they're 4 or 5 times higher. So we are not doing that well.
Let's go to another call now. Dwayne in Hayward. Go ahead, Dwayne.
Well, gun rates and gun death rates in the United States are very, very low to other causes. And he talks about funding. Why should we fund research into something that has some of the lowest causes of deaths in this country compared to other causes? Gun death rates don't even make the top 15 causes of death. Your researcher wants to spend money on more of a political issue than a social issue than the actual causes of death. Japan has a much, much higher suicide rate, and it's been proven there that if people don't have guns available and they want to kill themselves, they're going to use another cause or you find something else. He's focusing on gun suicides and not the overall rate of suicide. And guns play, in most countries, guns play a very low role. It doesn't matter whether someone kills themselves with a firearm, or they jump off a high building, or they gas themselves, which is very popular in Japan.
Okay, so how would you respond there to Dwayne, David?
So a number of things. First, yes, Japan has a very high suicide rate because they look at suicide very, very differently than we do. They had, you know, during World War II, they had kamikazes, and a suicide mission in Japan doesn't mean it's a high risk of death. It means you have to die, and if you don't die, you've shamed your family. So, you know, you're not controlling for things. It's just like saying Japan has a much higher, has a lower rate of heart disease, but they smoke more, so smoking must not matter. And the answer is no. The reason they have a low rate and they smoke more, smoking is still bad, but they do lots and lots of other things which are good for your heart, like much better diet. What we know about suicide is not only is there these 12, a dozen case control studies which show that a gun in the home increases the risk that someone in the home will die threefold likelihood compared to people in non-gun homes. But if you want to understand why cities have high rates of suicide in the United States versus low rates, if you want to understand why states have high rates of suicide than low rates, it turns out they have almost nothing to do with mental health. It almost has nothing to do with suicide ideation. It's very, very, very little to do with suicide attempts. It's all explained by different rates in gun suicide, because non-gun suicide rates are very, very similar across the states. And the gun suicide rates are really high where there's lots of guns, and they're much, much lower where there are a few guns. And so there you're comparing likes to likes, because states, you know, we have a very similar country across the states in terms of how we view suicide. But there's no question that in some other countries you have very, very different religious beliefs about suicide, very, very different social beliefs about suicide, which can explain vast differences in the suicide rates. Everybody, though, has similar beliefs about homicide, that it's not, you know, in the developed world, that it's not a good thing.
Another thing I want to get with Dwayne, he says research is a waste of money. Why is research so important?
Well, I just wrote a book about success stories and injury and violence prevention. It's called While We Were Sleeping. It's 64 documented successes about how the world's been made safer in terms of reducing injury and violence. And in virtually every one of those cases, data really mattered. Data mattered for showing that there was a serious problem, for suggesting here are good ways to reduce the problem, and then for showing whether or not the interventions made sense or not. To give a quick example, the data showed in the motor vehicle area that 16-year-olds were at incredibly higher risk of motor vehicle death compared to 19-year-olds and 40-year-olds. And the data also showed that two times they were at incredibly high risk was at night and when only other teenagers were in the car. So a couple of states said, all right, we'll let 16-year-olds drive because that's the only way they're going to learn how to, you know, negotiate the roads. but let's make it so they're safer, and so we let them drive, but they can't drive at night, and they can't drive when there's only other teenagers in the car. And then we have a good data system so we could see how did these states do compared to the other states, and immediately fatalities for these 16-year-olds dropped over 30%. And so once that was shown, then lots of other states followed suit, and very quickly all 50 states followed suit. And so motor vehicle deaths among these 16-year-olds dropped basically over 30%. And we have good data to show this because we have a good data system, and we've spent a little money on research. To give a notion about the disparities in gun research, here's data from the National Institutes of Health, our primary health funder. There are four diseases which are really, important diseases, and we should learn more about: cholera, diphtheria, polio, rabies. Over a very recent 40-year period, there were over close to 500 research grants where we learned a lot and helped reduce the problem. During that 40-year period, there are only 2,000 cases of all these. In the same 40-year period, there's only 3 research grants for firearms, even though there are more than 4 million people shot during that period. To think we don't have a problem because, heart disease is killing people in their 80s and 90s, and cancer is killing people in their 70s and 80s, and gun violence is killing people in their teens, in their 20s, in their 30s, and their 40s. So it's really killing a lot of younger people. And it's caller would have us only do research on heart disease and cancer, one would think, because that kills, 70, large percentage of Americans. But there's lots of other things which are incredibly important. And one of the things which is important, which we do very little research on, or almost none, or not nearly enough, is gun violence. Just to recognize, again, the first step in a public health approach is you have to convince people that this is a problem. Since 1968, since Martin Luther King was assassinated, there have been more Americans who have been civilians who have been killed by guns than all the soldiers who were killed on the battlefield in the United States in the history of the United States, including all of World War I and World War II, all the entire Civil War, and on and on and on. A lot of people are dying, and needlessly.
Taking another call now, let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Go ahead, Rich.
Good morning. Your guest just got close to answering my question. My question was, I had heard there was a ban or a prohibition or some sort of aversion in the National Institutes of Health to conducting systematic studies, collecting the data on gun violence in the United States. If that's true, I would say we're kind of at ground zero in that a lot of people are calling in and arguing anecdotally about what's true about gun violence. Can he address that point? That is the National Institute of Health hesitant or prohibited from systematically collecting data on gun deaths in the United States?
So there's not a direct prohibition, but there's an indirect prohibition, and these agencies learn how to live in the government. So, for example, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, did a small amount of gun research in the early 90s, and that research indicated that, as subsequent research has borne out, that a gun in the home is not a safety device. It really increases the risk that someone in the home will die violently from a homicide, particularly a woman in the home, a suicide, an unintentional gun death, and that guns were not seemingly protecting people at all. And the National Rifle Association couldn't stand this, and they got Republican Congress people in the Appropriations Committee to try to eliminate this. And they couldn't quite eliminate it, but they asked, how much money is being spent on this gun research? And it was $2.6 million, which turns out is very little. But so what they did is they immediately cut $2.6 million from the CDC injury budget and put it someplace else. And this was a shot across the bow. And subsequently, any time the CDC did anything about firearms research, they were brought in front of the Appropriations Committee and berated. So the CDC, for example, now does nothing at all. It's like a battered woman. It knows what it's allowed to do and what it's not allowed to do. So we have these mass shootings, and the Surgeon General says nothing. The head of the CDC, our primary public health agency, says nothing. The CDC stopped. There's this great data set, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which asks hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people every year about all different aspects of health and safety. And they used to have a couple gun questions on there. You know, do you have a gun in the home? How do you store your gun? And those were quickly eliminated. So now it's very, very hard to say with precision what percent of households in various states have guns and how are they storing their guns.
Rich, thanks so much for calling in with that question at 800-642-1234. David Hemenway is with us. He's a professor of health policy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's also the author of books on gun violence, including Private Guns, Public Health. David, TJ in Clinton called. He says he's learned that the new safety features on vehicles help initially, but the danger climbs back up after a few years. He asked, do we have data about how changes to guns make a difference? Is that long-term information?
So I don't think he's incorrect about changes in the motor vehicles. So when we had collapsible steering columns, the number of drivers being speared with steering columns fell dramatically and they stayed low. And that's true, you know, with airbags. Airbags indeed have gotten better over time, not worse. So initially, you know, first generation were good and they saved a lot of people, but they also killed some people. And now they basically kill nobody and they're much, much, much more effective. In the United States, guns, if anything, have gotten more concealable and more lethal. We have some data and some research, and what it indicates is that even though our medical care system has gotten much, much better trying to save lives, overall, we're not saving as nearly as many because where it used to be, you know, 40 years ago, someone would come in with one bullet wound. Now they come in with three or four bullet wounds. And even though the medicine is better, the trauma to the individual is much worse.
Let's take another call now. Brian in Madison. Go ahead, Brian.
I'd like to start off by commenting on your comments about the increase in the concealment of weapons. I've noticed that since the concealed carry law went into effect here in Wisconsin, I am noticing personally, witnessing more shootings. I live on East Washington, more shootings than Madison than I've ever witnessed before.
Okay,
But the larger issue that I wanted to raise was the fact that when it comes to these mass shootings, we have a serious issue where we have a lack of we live in a society where the individual is above all else, that community is looked on as a burden. And we don't respect each other's role in the community, and therefore otherizing and dehumanizing is easier and leads to violence in that respect.
Okay, and we're gonna have to leave it there, Brian, because we're about to go into a break. But David, I've put down Brian's comments here so we can discuss them after. On a typical day in our country, guns are used to kill almost 80 people and to wound nearly 300 more. If any other consumer product had this sort of disastrous effect, the public outcry would be deafening. This is from David Hemenway's book, Private Guns, Public Health. Getting your comments at 800-642-1234. Back after these news headlines. We're learning about gun violence this hour, how to curb the mass shootings, the daily violence of guns in America. David Hemenway is with us. He's a health policy professor at Harvard. He directs the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. You can join in as well with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. On Thursday, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi outlined the bills that Democrats are proposing to tighten background checks on gun sales and to ban bump stocks, these devices that allow a rifle to fire bullets as fast as a machine gun. Pelosi also said she asked House Speaker Paul Ryan to form a committee. Here's a bit of what she said.
We've asked the Speaker for a select committee on gun violence. You don't like these ideas? What ideas can we come together? This is a big issue in our country. It is overwhelmingly supported, the background checks, by the American people, even by large numbers of members of the National Rifle Association. Even though their organization doesn't support it, many of the members do.
David Hemenway, can a gun violence committee come up with anything new and different that has traction, that has legs to get out of committee?
I'm not an expert on politics, but what I can tell you is that there's ways to find common ground. There's ways in which people can work together, which is the spirit of public health. So, for example, in the suicide area, public health people have been working with gun advocates in trying to reduce suicide. So, for example, now in New Hampshire, about over half the gun shops have suicide prevention material because it's not the biggest problem of suicide, but often someone will come in and say, I want a gun. What kind of gun do you want? I don't care. How about this one? This is fine. How many bullets do you want? I only need one. And you don't have to sell that gun to this person. That person, you should help that person get some mental health attention. And so that's a really nice thing. Gun training. In the United States, for every unintentional gun death, there's something like 30 gun suicides. And gun training historically has focused almost entirely on unintentional firearm deaths and have done a fairly decent job at trying to reduce those. But now there's been attempts to increase the things covered in firearms training to include suicide. So, for example, Utah, which is a major gun training state, now for its concealed carry permits, the gun trainers are going to talk a little about suicide and how to reduce suicide. And a good way to reduce suicide that everybody can buy into is this notion of friends don't let friends drive drunk. Friends shouldn't also let friends who are going through a bad patch, your friend, he's going through a divorce, he's talking crazy, he's drinking, and you as a good friend should babysit his gun for a while till he gets a new girlfriend, and then he can have his gun back. And the gun owner should understand this, the friends of gun owners should understand this. This is a way to really make a dent in the suicide prevention and the suicide problem without any laws whatsoever, but just by changing social norms, the same way norms were changed about drunk driving.
Well, Brian and Madison had brought up a couple of things I wanted to make sure we addressed. He said he could almost feel the changes to concealed carry happened in his neighborhood. He felt almost an immediate impact. What would you say to that?
Well, we know guns cause trauma. Gun shootings, witnessing gun shootings cause trauma. There has been a good number of studies about concealed carry laws going from may issue to shall issue laws. And they've been, the problem, they don't have good disaggregated data. And so what it seems like is that these letting more and more people carry guns has increased the gun assault problem. But it's the verdict isn't in until we get better disaggregated data. One of the studies we did is in Massachusetts, we have a law which hasn't changed for years and years that says the police chief has some discretion over who can carry a gun, whereas most states now the police chief has no discretion. And we asked these police chiefs whether they liked the law, and of course they did. And then we said, tell us about instances where a person passed a background check but you did not let them have a concealed carry license. And that was only about 1% of the time. But these people, oh my goodness, these people, they'd been to this one police chief had been to this guy's home 5 times in the past month for domestic violence. And the guy was not a convicted felon, but he was clearly an alcoholic who was very violent and angry. And so he didn't give them a gun. One of the police chiefs, he asked the guy, why do you want a gun? And the guy said, honestly, I want to take the gun and shoot your deputy in the head.
No.
In the other states, almost all other states now, that person would have been allowed to have, would have, the police chief would have been required to give that person a concealed license, and he would never would have asked why you wanted the gun.
Let's take another call now. Michael in Madison. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you covered this question or not, because I signed on halfway through your program. But I haven't heard any statistics from the guests on the number of instances where gun violence was, or violence was avoided by the use of a weapon in the home defensively. How many people's lives have actually been saved by having access to a weapon in their home?
Do we know anything about this, David?
Yeah, there's a really good criminal justice data system, the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is the gold standard for what we know about crime in the United States, because a lot of crime is not reported to the police. And we looked at recent 5 years of their data. They have about 80,000 families that they interview twice a year and ask them about any time anyone attempted some crime against them. And we just looked at the contact crimes where one could have theoretically used a gun in self-defense. So you eliminate all the burglaries when no one was at home, or the car stealings when no one was around. And of all those instances, in less than under 1% of the time did the person use a gun in self-defense. About half the time they did something. They screamed, they ran away, they used another weapon. And in that 1% of the time, they were equally likely as doing anything else to be injured. So it did not look like it was using a gun was protecting the person from being injured, and it was so incredibly rare, even though guns are pretty ubiquitous in the United States. But again, only about a little over 20% of adults are gun owners, and about a third of households have guns. The one suggestive piece of evidence was that having a gun might reduce the likelihood that during a robbery that you would lose your Rolex watch, that there were fewer, the small number at the tiny 1% of the, under 1% of the cases where the individual used a gun in self-defense, they were somewhat less likely to lose property during a robbery, attempted robbery.
Michael, thanks so much for your question there. And Andy on Facebook has a proposition. He says, we could have a national sales tax on weapons, ammunition, and modifications, tie the rate to the number of gun deaths in the country each year. As deaths go up, so do costs. As they go down, gun shop owners and manufacturers are rewarded.
I'm an economist, so economists love to change people's behavior by changing prices. So,
right up your alley.
Right up my alley. So I like that. I do some work about obesity, and one of the things that looks like it's because there's actually better data than in my area than in the gun area, and also lots more money for research. And it really looks like a sweetened sugar tax on a sugar-sweetened beverages has some effect on childhood obesity. And it also raises money, which you can use for good purposes, hopefully.
Well, thanks, Andy, for that comment. Let's go to Bill now in Eau Claire. Go ahead, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I have one question. If you're so against the firearm itself, What are we doing to curb behavior? Because the firearm is nothing but a tool. The person will still find a way to do damage.
I'm not against the firearm. I'm against the injuries caused by firearms. And as I mentioned earlier, it turns out in almost all areas where there's been success in public health, it's by changing the environment and changing the tool rather than changing human behavior. You say, you know, I'm not against chainsaws, but you can make chainsaws more safe and you can make them less safe. There's a lot of things. And one of the nice things about being in public health is that our goal is not to increase gun sales or reduce gun sales. What it is to improve public health. And if the data indicated that having more guns was useful for public health, we were in public health, we'd be all for promoting more and more people having guns. The problem is that virtually every study shows that more guns and weaker gun laws lead to more problems and more death. And so we're trying to figure out what are appropriate ways. And it's fine to focus on, to look at the individual. Let's try to improve our education system, improve parenting. Let's try to figure out ways to make people less antisocial. Let's figure out ways to reduce gangs and so forth. But we also don't want to miss the typically what the approaches, which are much, much more cost-effective, which is to change the product and the environment.
David Hemenway, as you look into your crystal ball, what do you see in the future for gun violence across our nation?
Well, I'm always optimistic because there's been so many successes in public health. And in virtually every success, there were people, there were groups fighting strongly against it. And it's just incredible to me that you could have, that in every area, from seat belts to fire-safe cigarettes to even the great sanitation revolution in the 1900s, which was the 19th century, which was really the first major public health success. And there were people basically saying, you're not going to take the poop from our cities. We want our poop staying right here. And it's like, what are you thinking? Why are you doing that? After I wrote my book on success stories and injury and violence prevention, I thought I should write a book on who are the people who are against every possible intervention to make the world a safer place, but there were. And it's a constant struggle. And in all these areas, suddenly there is a tipping point. And people were against it and against it and against it, and then things tipped. And you could see this in tobacco smoking in the United States, where, you know, not that long ago, people considered the tobacco lobby the strongest lobby in the world, not just in the United States. And yet, we haven't solved the problem, but we've done lots better at protecting people against the problems caused by cigarette smoke.
We're going to leave it there. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That was David Hemenway. He is a professor of health policy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's the author of Private Guns, Public Health, from the University of Michigan Press. He recently wrote an opinion piece for the Boston Globe titled Tackling Gun Control as a Public Health Problem. The Morning Show is produced by Nyasia Ellison and Keely Boltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer, and she provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us.